Welcome to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. We're here again, Janet and I, to have an interview, which I hope you will love, of Pamela Marriston, who has lived on island for a long, long time. When did you come, Pamela?
I came in 1975, so I've been here 35 years, and I don't think I'm actually an old-timer yet. I think you have to be here a lot longer, maybe even born here.
Have to be born here in order to consider. And the young ones who were born here, can they call themselves old-timers? I'm not so sure.
Boy, that's a good question.
I was just thinking that, too.
Yeah. I think they could.
Yeah, they could, because, they really are Lopezians.
Natives.
Native. Well, when you came in the mid-70s, that means that you were part of the Back to the Land movement. Many people who wanted to live more simply.
Yeah, we definitely were smitten by that idealism, and as soon as we found a place on Lopez to come to, we were pretty much, planted. And we came and came up this long road into the woods and parked our truck. And I think it was really well known right then that it was home. It was really obvious.
So had you looked for land, or did you just drive up a random road?
To home.
Squatting.
No, we had. I was living down in Marin, or we were living down in Marin, and we started looking for another place because it became obvious that it was time to leave civilization as we knew it then, and try out some of the ideas that were floating around about growing gardens and everything. But so we looked a lot in California, and then we were about to look in Oregon. And a friend of ours said, oh, I think you should come to the San Juans. I'm going up there this summer, and you could have a ride up with me, but then you have to get your way home. So we did. We came up and helped him out at the marina with his sailboat for a bit, and then he gave us his car, and we drove around on the, coast here and looked around and didn't see anything we liked. And so we came over on the ferry. And honestly, I just got on the ferry, and my heart just broke open. It was just stunning, that just awareness that this was so awesome. So, yeah. So, and then
and,
we looked
and how
with our,
did you choose Lopez? It was the first ferry stop?
No, we actually consulted a realtor, and he took us around to the different islands, and nothing seemed to click. And finally, I think he got tired of us because he said, oh, I think I know what you want. It's not for sale, but I'll take you there. So he took us up the long road, and we camped there overnight. He left us there and came and got us the next day.
Oh, wow.
And it was definitely a hit.
Huh?
Yeah.
So then you called the people and asked them if they'd sell?
Yeah, we called the guy. It actually was John Giard, and he owned the land.
The father of Jack?
Yes, uh-huh. And he wasn't interested in selling that particular piece to us. He was interested in hanging on to it. But at some point he said, but I do have one for sale across the road. And, of course, it was all wooded. And being from the city, we couldn't imagine what we were going to do with it. It was just beyond us. But anyway, we saw it. We went back to, I had a little house that I was able to sell. And we called him up and said, we'd like it. And so we actually took it. And that's when we drove up the long road with not much in our camper and the kids and parked
How
at
many
the
kids?
End of the road. Well, I had two of the kids with us. And we didn't have anything, so to speak. A few sleeping bags and camper shell. So we parked and camped, and it was February.
Oh, my God. Lovely time of year.
Now, so, how old were your kids at the time?
They were 5 and 7.
Wow.
And might I say that they thought they had dropped into hell.
In February, I could see that. Yeah.
But we had run across somebody who knew of a place that we might rent, and that was Steve Young's. and we had their phone number. Of course, they weren't there, but we called and never got him or his wife. And we kept calling because they said, oh, this place you could probably move into. Anyway, we several weeks later, we had really had it with the cold, rainy weather and our very minimal situation. So we were about to head south and go to Guatemala or somewhere. And I made one last call to him, and he was there. And actually, I guess I talked to his wife, but she said, oh, well, I don't know why you just didn't open the window and move in. Which, of course, I would never have dreamed of doing. But so that changed our course. We didn't go south. We stayed, and we had the good fortune of being neighbors with Greg and Edie, and they taught us so much. They were just invaluable in just helping us to understand more about living in the country and all the skills we would need. And of course, they were so, you know, skillful and had so much that was really exemplary, you know, as far as living this way. So that was really great.
And how long had they lived on Lopez when you met them, do you know?
I think they might have been here maybe 4 years or so earlier than us.
Yeah, a little longer.
Yeah.
Because when Greg came and he talked to us on KLOI, and he mentioned the fact that it was the old-timers that helped him along,
mm-hmm.
and told him what to do and how to garden and,
oh.
you know, all the different things, because he was totally at sea.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, of course, he became the person
yeah.
who could instruct
yeah.
others.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah,
this is
goes.
Greg Blomberg for
yeah.
people who didn't catch it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Lovely. Yeah.
And so then did you start clearing and then building? And
that must have been a lot of clearing
yeah.
if you have the wooded place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we moved into the Youngs and stayed there for the winter, probably till May. And then we cleared a little spot that we started a platform for a house.
Is that where is that little octagon-like
no,
shape?
That's,
no,
that's
oh.
actually where the house is right now.
Oh,
yeah.
That's where, okay, I see.
But we were really quite naive about, you know, things. And so we chose to build our house right where it was easiest to clear, which had a lot of really small alders on it. Well, of course, it was very wet, and
mm-hmm.
that was really not a very smart move. But
by that time, you did not know that alders grow in wet places.
That's right. Yeah. And but originally, we built a 11 by 13 sort of a lean-to with plastic on it, visqueen, and called it El Plastico. And it was quite tight with four of us. And I remember sleeping in it one night, and it was raining like crazy, and waking up in the middle of the night and seeing this humongous bubble that was sinking, filled with water over the kid's bed. And I had to reach up and push it up and push all the water out. And that was like, oh, my God.
Wouldn't that be a shock to me? Rainwater splashing on you.
Yeah. So, yeah, so we camped out for quite a while and had very minimal housing for quite a while. A lot of plastic, I remember. Lots of rolls of visqueen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you were just mentioning, I mean, just since you mentioned your children, I liked the little story about you, that you said it was such a different time and a different place with your kids and how you didn't have a telephone.
Yeah, we didn't have a telephone for 12 years. And my kids, actually we would go over to the Macaulay farm and use the phone for emergencies and those long distance calls that we couldn't.
That was quite a ways, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the most telling thing about those times was that the kids, they really were on their own a lot. And they ran, at that point, they had met up with the Steckler kids. And so they kind of ran in a pack, the Stecklers and the Frenolis, and that was Paul and Mia and Scott and Janet. No. I mean, Scott, excuse me, not Scott and Janet. Scott and Heidi and Chris and Robin. And they all ran in this pod. And because we couldn't call back and forth a lot, we just had to trust that they were at each other's house if they didn't show up for dinner or a couple of days later. So it was just really different. I learned a lot more about trusting that my kids were being cared for somewhere and vice versa. So it was great training and parenting.
Wonderful. So slowly you got other things to make life more comfortable. But as I understand it, you're actually still one of the people who lives very much off the grid and off a lot of other things. Will you tell a little bit about that?
Because we were interested in the philosophies and the movement of the, the energy crunch that was forcing people to look at use of power. So because where we lived up our road didn't have power, we started developing a different way of living where we weren't dependent on it. And at this point, on Lopez Sound Road up in the Lopez Hill area, there's a whole neighborhood of people that live off the grid, like Stephen and Wendy and Paul Lewis and Amy and Craig and Paul Frenoli. It's like we're in this little, and Cedar and Farida, they're all up there. We all have, low use of electricity. We have solar and batteries and inverters and pretty much, rely on a lot of hand things. And it's, we don't have flush toilets. We have outhouses. We have, most of us have minimal bathing situations. I think up until about a year ago, I had my bath outside in a big tub that was underneath an overhang. We heat water with on-demand heaters, or some of us have upgraded to a regular hot water heater. We pump our water up from a pond and gravity feed down into a tank, and then that's our water in our house. We filter a little bit of it out every day and for drinking water, but that seems to be fine. And so we're...
And those kind of things that you have to do are part of your daily living and incorporated in your day. In other words, for people who'd never done it, it would seem, oh my gosh, this is going to be so time-consuming. But...
Well, it's actually not as time-consuming as it used to be because, I mean, we have upgraded a lot and, things are run pretty smooth, pretty smooth. But I think it's more like we just do without a lot of the things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just...
But you would never know that by walking into your house. It's a beautiful home. I mean, doing without, I don't know if you're doing without anything as far as I can tell.
Well, we don't feel like we are,
no,
actually.
No, I don't think you are.
Yeah.
It's quite lovely.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, folks, it's all doable.
And do you still cook on a wood stove?
I used to up until about 15 years ago. I got, as an addition, I got a little boat stove that I put in my kitchen. So I had both. And then as I've gotten older, I just kind of gravitated more towards the propane stove. We don't have a big family around a lot, so the small stoves seem to work for us. And then just recently, I sold my cook stove, and it went up to Alaska. Amazing. We always said if we were going to have to move because of the things getting worse down here, that we would go to Alaska with our cook stoves and our compost piles. So at least my cook stove made it.
Your cook stove made it.
Without you. My compost pile's still here.
So when did you start with solar panels? Did that already start in the 70s?
Well, it did, but we didn't.
I was going to say it was very new then.
Yeah.
Yeah, the way I remember
it. Yeah, no, I honestly can't remember when we got our first ones. We did get a generator pretty soon after we were here because there were some things that we needed, like power tools for building.
Right.
Yeah, things like that. And so a generator, generates electricity. And so some of the things that we needed to do, we could do with that. Mm-hmm. Like, in fact, I do a lot of sewing for people, and I have a big industrial machine that I can't run unless I turn on the generator. Mm-hmm. So still need it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you do a lot of sewing for people. That's one way to make some money. Mm-hmm. Did you have other ways?
Boy, I've never been good at making money, actually. I mean, I've gotten by with a lot of the different skills that I have. And I do sewing for people. I've done a lot of gardening for people. I've worked in stores. Pretty much whatever comes up.
Well, I was just remembering, Ollie told me that you and Dana made these cushions that were sitting on the covers.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm looking at them, and how long ago was that?
That was in 1984.
They are in perfect condition. They're beautiful. They have zipper covers. It's your work that you do is amazing. Like, I remember you made Heidi Steckler's wedding dress.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the most beautiful dresses I've ever seen. And all of your art, I mean, if you tell us a little bit about what type of art you've come from and now you're doing, it's shifted since I've lived here for 20 years. So are you mainly, what kind of art do you do now? And I know you don't necessarily get paid for it, but it'd be nice to.
Well, I think I've always felt myself to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to credit my dad for instilling in me this spark of creativity. I appreciate it for myself. But I've always made things. I've always been crafty with things, and that's a lot of joy for me. So sewing has been with me a long, long time. I've made so many different kinds of things. Clothing.
Doll clothes.
Cushions. Doll clothes. Puppets. Draperies. I've sewed millions of things for theater.
Costumes,
really. Yeah.
Which is a whole different thing. When you say sewing, then it sounds very basic, but none of this is basic.
Mm-hmm.
This is artistic. This is developing, an idea and making it into something that is stunning.
Mm. And button blankets. Loved making button blankets.
Now, button blankets, that would be something to tell a little bit more about, because I don't think many people really know what button blankets is all about.
Many years ago, I became acquainted with the Native Americans of the West Coast, and they have a tradition in their ceremonies that they create and use button blankets there for honoring, for paying attention to special things that people either belong to or have done in their life. And I've always been really taken by them. They're really stunning. They're wool, and they have usually a lot of embellishment of lots of buttons and designs that are created for, like they've done a lot of totems and insignias that where people belong to different clans and all that. And that was really fascinating to me. And then when I turned 50, or just before turning 50, Irene called me. She wanted to make a button blanket for Irene Sky River. She wanted to make a button blanket for her dad. And her dad and her family has Native American heritage. And so we conferred and created this beautiful blanket for her dad. And boy, I just was so taken by the whole experience. And then when I turned 50, I got one. It was so awesome. Mm. I was given it as a total surprise. I was totally shocked and found out that all these people had gotten together to sew on it for me. I was just like, so, like, wow, what a gift of love.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
And you call them blankets, but if I understand it correctly, some of them are more like capes.
Well,
that can be worn.
They do wear them as capes. You know, a lot of them have a button on the front that they can close it. And they're used for dances. But then as the years went on and I got really involved in creating button blankets along with other people, Irene and I created quite a few together in the designs. And then, but always getting a group of people to work together to sew on them. And that was just so awesome because, I mean, here's all these people. They come, they talk about the person that's that they're making it for, and there's all this, you know, just love and craft going in for this person, and it's so fun to surprise them with it. Mm-hmm. That's the best part. And would you ask me?
But so now you would like to, you said you, earlier you said that you'd like to make more and make it so people understand it a little bit more. It doesn't have to be, it's just something more, I could feel your emotion with just getting together with people and expressing how much you care about someone through using your hands. I mean, it's a lot like a quilting circle, really.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I've seen these blankets. They're a tapestry. Mm. It's like something you'd hang on your wall. It could. I remember for some reason, Paul Lewis, when he turned 50, and him and Dennis, but I remember Paul's because his dog had died not long before, and you created, you and many, many others, I don't know who designed it, but it was a blanket of a beautiful dog, and
it was for Dennis, but...
The dog was for Dennis?
But Dennis loved that dog so much and was kind of like a surrogate parent.
Oh, I thought it was the other one. Oh, no, well, there we go. But I guess the blanket itself was... Mm-hmm. It could be anything.
Mm-hmm.
The image on the blanket could portray anything.
Well, I think in answer to you, Ollie, we have made some capes, and we did make one for Hildegard.
Right.
That was a cape.
With a cat on the back.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Because we felt like she could actually wear that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she did.
And she did. Yeah.
Yeah. So lovely.
Yeah, it's so fun to figure out what it is that to put on the blanket that would represent some kind of essence of that person.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, what does yours have on it?
Mine has a diving otter. And I was blessed to get a design that was actually created by Barry Harum, who's really well known Northwest Coast artist who created the diving otter, and then the side panels were I think Irene conferred with Steve Brown, who's also really well-known Northwest Coast artist, so it's pretty special.
Lovely. Well, I'm very glad to have a little more background about button blankets.
One thing I would like to say, though, about them is that I think there's some misconception about how you get one. Because I know I've heard people say, I'd love to have one, or maybe some comment about, you have to be in the club or something. And I really want to dispel the sense that it's elite. It's not. All it means is that somebody who loves you, or if you love someone else, that you would like to create a blanket for is just... That's where it starts. And it doesn't mean that you belong to anything, or it's just a piece that's developed out of caring.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, if anybody would like to make one for somebody, call me up. I'll help you get started.
Great. You talked to us about the fact that you have an artistic eye, and that's what you have used in many different ways, and some of them have to do with landscaping. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a bit about that?
I have really enjoyed working with people with, you know, if there's, say someone has this nice house or, you know, a piece of land out in front of their place or maybe a pond site or something, and they just really don't know how to think about it. It's been really fun to be able to go over and help them to plan how they might develop their garden, their pond, the trafficking through other yards, how things work together, maybe some landscape architecture, like, you know, trellises, trees, fences, lots of things like that, and just see how it can work together as a artistic piece.
And also, I mean, I think it's something like we've talked about over the years of just trying to figure out how to earn a living on Lopez. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me like a good thing to have, like to have someone come in, to be able to come in either to your yard or even like, I know you're really good with colors. Mm-hmm. You go into someone's house and help them to figure out what colors to use on their walls or artwork to hang. And that's something that I know that I imagine that I would love to be able to have you come in, and you have helped me before. Mm. And it's a good thing to know about people. And that's an interesting, you have a very good eye for all those types of things.
I've heard people say a critical eye.
Well, critical, yeah. But yeah,
it
I would agree.
That.
But
yeah.
It does
yeah.
need it. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just
yeah.
agree with
yeah.
everything.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I hope by this radio show, maybe someone will call you up and say, I need my room painted a certain color. I need help with that, or my yard. Or,
mm-hmm. Interior decorating.
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Landscaping.
And if I remember correctly, you have helped with many plays on island with the costumes.
Mm-hmm.
Designing them? Mm-hmm. Or finding some that had to be redone so that they would fit certain people or certain parts?
Yeah, a lot of I've worked with Carol Steckler since the beginning of the, I guess, Lopez Community Theater is what we would call it. I'm not sure we called it that then, but with Island of Zapol, that was kind of the first play that we did, and we made all the costumes and sets.
What was the play?
Island of Zapol. I think Connie Martin, known as White Bear Woman, she wrote it. And it was a fantasy, and it was really fun because there was lots of kids in it and lots of fun costumes and sets. We did it at Widman Hall, which was the Legion Hall at that point. And so over the years, I've developed a love for working in theater. It's a wonderful venue for a way to get to know a certain segment of community and have fun with them for a period of time. It's very meaningful, the experience of going to a common focus together. And so over the years, I've made a lot of the costumes, and then I got into doing the sets, and it's just been so rewarding, just the artistic stretching over, you know, when you get given a play, a theme, and you have to do this mind stretch over creating something within the confines of a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting puzzle to be created and solved. And the costumes, I would say, have come entirely from the thrift stores and the dump and borrowing, at least the ones that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thank my sources. They've been good to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so many artistic people come forward for theater. It's really phenomenal to see what people know how to do and pull it off. It's amazing.
One of the places I remember was our town.
Mm-hmm.
That was also in now Woodman Hall.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do the costumes of the set for that one?
Mm-hmm.
You,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember Jim Butlong with the cow.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I understand you will also help with planning, like big occasions, weddings, or special celebrations.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've done a lot of consulting and coordinating of weddings and parties and big events. But, you know, it's interesting. That evolved over time, too, because as the community grew, you know, there was more opportunity to understand how events worked. There's sort of a common flow to them about how they begin and how they get to the end. And so a lot of the parts in it are very similar to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've never seen an ad with your skills in any paper. It must all go by word of mouth.
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Ah, lovely. Now, one thing that you probably can shed some light on, people ask about what is this business about potlucks? I mean, there are always potlucks on Lopez. Where did they come from?
Well, I think that the early people, I mean, before me, that was a form of socializing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't the community center. There weren't concerts and plays and, you know, all the things, the socializing opportunities that we have now. And the school was quite small, so the only way that people could get together was they ate together.
Yeah.
And they all brought food.
Yeah.
And they met in each other's homes. So it was, you know, everybody came, which was not a huge amount of people at that point, and all the kids came. You know, nobody stayed home. And, yeah, it was very interesting. The food's really changed, too. I've noticed that. Kinds of food, yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, Scott used to say he'd go over to your house and you would get that food that you, it was always like, greens and brown rice and you know.
I know, they hated it.
He loved going to your house, but he often talks about the food that
I
he had
know.
To eat as a kid.
I'm so sorry.
Well, now a lot of the kids are eating that, you know.
Yeah.
But then
yeah.
It was probably. But what do you mean by the foods now? Like,
well, like that. I mean, I think it's very common to, you know, have a lot of vegetarian things and a lot of vegetables and salads and.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, people didn't eat like that so much then.
Before,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And potlucks are still a big part of I know, my life and I know your life. And
you can count on everything tasting very good.
Yeah.
Which is a total amazement if you go someplace else and they have a potluck. It's a different story.
I know.
Yeah. And I do wonder in different communities how common potlucks are. I imagine...
We used to do potlucks where we lived in California, but there were always people who could not stand the idea of not knowing what was going to be on the table. And so she tried to organize it until it was no longer a potluck.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And we had to kind of fight that, you know, say, just let everybody bring something. Of course, we have had occasions here that there were nothing but desserts.
Oh, I know. I know.
For my daughter's birthday, we tried a theme of Asian food, and that was an interesting potluck. What in people's mind that means, you know, and it, you know, Asia is a broad spectrum, so it was an interesting potluck.
I remember somebody saying that they went to a potluck like you were talking about, and there was mainly desserts.
Yeah.
And where was the meal?
Yeah. And I think the children loved it.
Mm-hmm.
No problem whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking about, because I never quite got my question answered with the artwork that you do, because when I first moved here, I remember, was it oil or is it pastels that
I did watercolors.
Acrylic? Because you were doing watercolors, mm-hmm. and so now your art has completely changed, because we've talked about your sewing skills mm-hmm. and all of these other things, but for me, I think the first that I ever knew of you was more the canvas, mm-hmm. and you haven't mentioned that at all. I'd just like you to talk about it a little bit. Also, why did it change? What in you changed mm-hmm. from your medium, from watercolor to, if it's oil that you're doing, or acrylics?
Well, I think I was in love with watercolors mm-hmm. then, but my style was really different too. It was very controlled and
circular
and hard-edged, and I had these things that I wanted to say that were specific. I had these really big titles that went with my work that were things I was thinking about inside myself, and so I did that for a while, and that was really useful for me. And then I went away from painting for a while. I started doing other things. But a couple of years ago, I decided to start painting again, and I realized that I was older, my eyesight has changed, so my skill level point was really different, and I couldn't depend on the precision. I wasn't really interested in it either, but it was just something I was noticing. So I started doing acrylics, and they became looser, and also the subject material turned into my environment. Mm-hmm. So I walk in the woods a lot, and I spend a lot of time outdoors, and it just became this kind of outpouring of everything that was around me and that I knew. And it was very rewarding, and I feel like I'm in this sort of big zone with it. So I'm about to start another
big zone being
big zone. I feel like I'm in a home zone with how my art is, what it's developed to. Mm-hmm. And my comfort level with it is very easy.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I guess the reason why I brought it up is because it's so different. Mm-hmm. You know, the lighter, the pastel, the watery, into these bold, strong... I mean, you said you had an edge to your watercolor, but looking at it from a distance, I have more circular softness in my mind. And these other pieces are, you know, just... almost a pure color, or just mm-hmm. a darker color, and it's yeah. more of a statement to each yeah. of them, it seems like. Yeah. They're equally both beautiful. I'm mm-hmm. like them both. I'm drawn to your artwork a lot.
Thank you. Well, I expect to be doing a lot more. I feel like I have some spaciousness in my life right now, so I'm looking forward to that.
I was remembering in the 80s, by that time, you must have built your house, your really house, nothing plastic about it anymore.
Still building.
Well, of course, a house on Lopez is never finished. But but I do remember that there were quite a few occasions when we used your great room mm-hmm. for all kinds of things. I remember Cynthia brought us there for a special storytelling retreat when all of us had to suddenly become somebody different, and you had shoved all furniture aside, and so we had plenty of space to move around in. Mm-hmm. And I remember a Passover at your house. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about why did everybody come to you?
Well, I think it was not particularly coming to me, but to this bigger room than most people had. For some reason, we had built a bigger living area, and the furniture wasn't nailed down or built in, so we could push everything aside. And so we did. We had, if you needed to, you know, have some event that was more than five people, you could call us up, and we would say yes. And we had, you know, everything there, meetings and dances and classes and parties and drumming circles, and And boy, my floors sure look it too. They are totally worn out. But it was fun. It was really part of those times, and there was lots of really fun gatherings, and I think we were just an incredibly vibrant community at that point, and we hadn't gotten too big yet.
Right.
Which I think is different now. Mm. Yeah.
And in what ways do you feel the bigness? I mean, how is it affecting your life?
Well, I used to feel like I could really keep in touch with, on a more intimate level, the people that I knew here. But now I feel like I do know a lot more people, and there's a lot of people I would love to spend time with, but I think we're all just, you know, spinning in certain circles that require more of our attention, and it's just harder to spend time with people in the same way.
Are you aware of the fact, and maybe I'm wrong in thinking this, but on the mainland, people are extremely busy. Their days are filled to the brim. Mm-hmm. And I used to think that on Lopez, we were more relaxed. There was always an opportunity for an unexpected visit, for, you know, taking time to really connect with people. And nowadays, I feel that that has become much harder.
I really agree. Yeah. We didn't used to call or know when somebody was coming over. People would just come over, and that was fine. It was just drop in.
Yeah.
And we had time for them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And nowadays, it may take, I don't know how many phone calls and message machines and mm-hmm. whatnot before you finally connect mm-hmm. and have an opportunity to say, can we get together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I find that a little scary because it's like something...
It's a loss.
Something that was very enjoyable and comforting and stimulating at the same time is getting lost. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's the, you know, there's so much that's going on here. And honestly, a lot of it is great. I would love to attend all of it. But it's just too much. It's not what I want to do, is spend my time going out to things and doing things like that. You know, I came here for a certain reason, which was to enjoy nature and live a less stimulated life. And it's hard to hang on to that.
I've heard people say it's almost more stimulating here because you know more people a little bit more than you would in the city. And the island is smaller, so you can actually drive quickly from one thing to the next. If you lived in the city, it would be more of a longer schedule. Yeah. And having young children, I find it difficult to kind of keep up. And keep, and also on the same hand, keep it, I feel like I need to keep it rolling at the same time, which is a really hard balance to have.
Yeah, we've definitely become more, I don't know if I would put urbanized on it, I wouldn't, but civilized, I guess, something.
I don't know what to call it, because it's also the electronic world that, you know, has kind of taken over everything.
Yeah.
And so...
as we're talking into a tape recorder, right?
Yes. Yes.
It's not a tape recorder.
Oh, that's right. It's not. Oh, my God. Am I a Luddite? Yes.
It is a recorder.
It used to be, but I still call it that, too.
Yeah. But that also seems like an invasion of our natural world. Mm-hmm. You know. But, you know... What can we do about it?
Well, that's a question that, living the way I do, I entertain a lot because, okay, there's this holding back from being dragged ahead so fast, you know, with technology. But there's also a feeling of not wanting to be left out of things, too, so that, I mean, as a thinking person, you know, you want to keep up with things. So it's I'm not sure what the balance is.
No. Yeah. I think that's a very difficult one to answer. really.
It is, and what I've noticed about you, Pamela, before is, Scott, my husband, talks to me a lot about choices, making choices. Mm-hmm. And I find, like, with you, you do make choices clearly. If you are going to go out in the week, you probably choose one day a week rather than, oh, I can do these four things. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be part of our society, is just making choices, limiting ourselves rather than everything is better. Rather than a few mm-hmm. opportunities to make it to be equally as good or maybe even better if it's not so rushed. And I think technology is part of that.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I know the biggest thing I don't struggle with it so much now, but that I have when the community started getting really large was, and there was so much going on, was that I felt like I didn't want to be left out, or I didn't want to not show up because it would, you know, be that I didn't care. And that's not that wasn't it. I did care, but I couldn't do everything. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so it's hard to know what the right action is in those things.
Yeah. The balance of life.
Juggling.
Right.
Teaching juggling in school is, I think, a great skill for that very reason.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's being taught.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember it just spontaneously jumped into my head, but and this is just a short little thing, but do you remember the wheelbarrow you were just talking about a little bit earlier? Your kitchen, you know, because we're still in that. I like to think of your home without the flushing toilet, mm-hmm. living off of the grid, and all of those things that people think aren't really in existence too much in a larger sense in the particularly the States, I think. I mean, although I go to Alaska, I've gone to Alaska, and there's a lot of that happening there. But what happened this last Thanksgiving?
Oh, it wasn't this last Thanksgiving. It was the one before, but we don't have room for a turkey. I have cooked on a little boat stove, which has a tiny oven. Actually, my sister calls it my Barbie toy stove. but we had all the relatives there, and we needed to cook the giant turkey, and so we did it over at Paul and Lupin's, and they have a large oven, regular size. Cook over there, and then when it's time for dinner, after we've orchestrated all the pies and side dishes, you know, going coursing through the various stoves on top or in, everything's sort of lukewarm. Anyway, somebody runs over with the turkey in the wheelbarrow.
In the wheelbarrow. I love that part.
And we have the, looks like normal Thanksgiving.
Which it is.
It is.
Yeah.
Perfectly normal.
Yeah. Just the turkey's delivered in the wheelbarrow.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me what I just read yesterday. A Kurt Vonnegut joke. There was a man who was obviously a smuggler, and so the customs officer could not figure out what he was smuggling. He would always come with his wheelbarrow, and they would check what was in it, and you know, no, it was okay, he could take that. So the customs officer was getting older, and he was about to retire, and so he said to the man, well, we have known each other for a long time, so would you tell me what you are smuggling? Then he said, I'm smuggling wheelbarrow.
Oh, no!
Very funny.
That's a good joke.
Right in front of your face.
And I was thinking of that when I saw your turkey.
That's so funny.
Dick turkey.
On the wheelbarrow.
So in the future, like just living on Lopez, what do you see for yourself? I mean, it could. That's a big question, but I, in terms maybe of artwork or even potentially income or travel. But I know you don't want traveling's not a part of.
No,
of
I'm
your,
homebody. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely homebody. I'm quite content to be there. Art.
Mm-hmm. In all forms.
Or well,
are you just
I
trying to focus.
I
on?
Still love to garden, and mm-hmm. of course, it's my visions and labors have shrunk quite a bit over the years.
Although a lot of us who don't garden that much would say, oh, it's not that small.
But I do a kitchen garden, and it's very nourishing. Yeah, that and art.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you freeze or can, or do you only
use... We do a winter, you know, we grow winter things and pretty much eat a lot of kale. Mm-hmm. A lot of kale, and more kale. And
and Swiss chard.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes. And Bob does a lot of hunting, so we eat that. And, you know, we hunt at the Lopez Village Market, too. and Blossom.
Right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't like canned food. I don't like... And we don't
have processed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I don't like that kind of food, and we don't have a freezer. We borrow a small drawer of a freezer of Jerome's, and we have to drive on the way to town. We drop it off and pick it up there, but we don't have any preservation that way. So.
And did you have? How long has it been since you've had a refrigerator? Is that the?
Well, we always had. Well, not always. We had a propane refrigerator for our. Some years, and then we just recently got a very energy economical refrigerator that does not have a freezer, and it's only the bottom half of a refrigerator, but it's very you know, it's very padded and
holds. It's a good size too.
Well, people used to preserve things, what was it called, down in the ground, you know, the vegetables. And
you dig a hole.
It's the root vegetables.
Yeah, the root vegetables.
Yeah, root cellar or a
root cellar.
Yeah, or in sawdust.
Yeah. Do you do that?
Mm-mm.
No.
Well, I think Scott and I were talking about that because when we went to Nepal, they're still they do that there, but the ground's drier. I think the ground's too moist
Wet, probably.
I think it, unless you had it insulated with something.
Yeah, I think you need the right kind of situation for it.
For.
Also, there's a lot of things that like to find what you've put away if you don't have.
Oh,
the right kind of
for
storage.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You would not find very much of your precious vegetables.
Well, even over the last few years, I've had tons of voles in my garden, and all the carrots, all the beets, all the potatoes are gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I've had the same thing. Yeah. I would be so careful and have prepared the soil carefully, and the plants would just. Disappear.
Yeah. It's like they get pulled under. So
terrible. That's totally, you know, takes all the pleasure out of it.
Yeah,
because, you know, it's an effort, and I was not a gardener by nature, so, you know, it takes an extra effort.
Yeah,
I feel that about the deer around our home.
Know. Yeah, gardening's challenging here with the varmints.
So. Well, you know, it's very interesting because what you have been talking about balance and choices, I think we can all benefit from that philosophy as we grow older, when so much of it depends not so much on choices, because the choices are forced upon us, but on trying to keep a balance and still lead the kind of life that you would like to lead with the limited resources that you have available to you. So I think Pamela's philosophy can be used by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
We have come to the end of our hour, and thank you very much, Pamela.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Ali Smulders with Janet Balzer for another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. This program was pre-recorded.